Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Story 1. Fear doesn't always come from shadows or whispers in the dark. Sometimes it's the living, breathing people you stumble across who leave you with the kind of chills that no ghost story can touch. When I was 13, I finally convinced my mom to let me do something I'd been begging to do for years. Go on a night bike ride. She reluctantly agreed, but set rules. I had to wear my helmet, bring my phone, carry a flashlight, and stay within the 4-mile stretch she marked out. Inside those boundaries, the streets curved near houses and yards, safe and close to people. The outside of that invisible fence was different. Open spaces, dirt paths, and spots she never trusted. The first ride was everything I hoped for. The air felt cooler, the world quieter. No kids running around, no barking dogs, no neighbors watering their lawns. Just me and the sound of my tires spinning on pavement. It felt like freedom. That freedom went to my head fast. When I hit one of the steep slope paths cutting between neighborhoods, I pushed harder, flying downhill at a speed that made my stomach drop. In seconds, I had crossed the edge of my mom's limits, chasing the thrill. The further I pedaled, the fewer house lights I saw. Soon it was just the faint glow of windows behind me, fading the deeper I went. The dirt path stretched in front of me, uneven and narrow, with tall grass brushing my legs as I rode. I told myself I'd turn back after a few more minutes, but that's when I heard it. Singing. It was faint at first, almost carried by the wind. A woman's voice. She wasn't singing words, just the melody of a song. My brain registered it after a few seconds. It was the tune from Eleanor Rigby by the Beatles, but broken, almost wrong. The voice was rough, like it came from someone with a sore throat. It didn't sound like something you'd expect to hear that far from the houses. I stopped pedaling and coasted, straining my ears. The singing wasn't ahead in the distance like I thought. It was close. Too close. Maybe 30 or 40 feet in front of me. My heart started hammering. I told myself it was just some woman out there, maybe walking her dog or drunk. But the path wasn't exactly popular, especially not at night. I slowly inched forward, letting my tires crunch the dirt as quietly as possible. In the moonlight, I made out a figure, a head moving up and down, hair swinging with the motion, like someone nodding to music only they could hear. I froze, unsure what to do. The flashlight in my pocket suddenly felt heavy. A part of me thought she might need help. Another part thought shining the light would be a mistake. After a long pause, I pulled it out, pointed it at her, and clicked it on. The beam hit her back. She went completely still. The bouncing stopped. Her hair was long but dirty, matted together in thick clumps. Whole patches of it were missing. She wore a hoodie so oversized it practically swallowed her frame. Bright red but filthy. The kind of thing that had been dragged through mud too many times. She didn't turn around. She just stood there, unmoving. The silence that followed was worse than the singing. My stomach knotted, and I felt this urge to shrink into the ground. I forced myself to mutter an apology, quick and nervous, like when you walk into the wrong room. She didn't answer. She didn't even twitch. I clicked off the flashlight and shoved it into my pocket, trying to convince myself to leave. My hands were shaking as I turned my bike around. That's when it happened. She screamed. The sound cut through the night, sharp and high-pitched, so loud I almost dropped my bike. It wasn't a scream of pain. It was furious, unhinged, like she wanted me to hear it deep in my bones. My instincts took over, and I threw myself onto the seat, pedaling as hard as I ever had in my life. Behind me, the screaming didn't stop. It grew louder at first, like she was chasing me. I didn't dare look over my shoulder. The only thing I focused on was the path under my wheels and the burning in my legs as I pushed harder and harder. The sound eventually grew distant, blending into the wind rushing past my ears. By the time I saw the glow of houses again, my lungs felt like they were on fire. I coasted the last stretch home, shaking so hard I could barely hold the handlebars. When I finally rolled my bike into the garage, I collapsed onto the floor, listening, waiting for that scream to come back. It never did. I never told my mom the truth. I said I'd gotten spooked by how dark it was, but I never rode outside her boundaries again. Story 2. People think haunted houses are terrifying, but empty buildings full of people are much worse. They carry silence like it's alive, stretching through every hallway, echoing in ways that make you question if you're really alone. That's what working in a college dorm during the summer felt like sometimes. Big halls with only a handful of students scattered inside, each one keeping to themselves. Summers on campus were nothing like the regular school year. Instead of hundreds of students filling the halls with constant noise, there were maybe 30 or so left. They were usually the high-achieving types, buried in their books and their own stress. So the building stayed unnervingly quiet. You could walk the halls in the middle of the afternoon and hear your own footsteps echo back. One day in late June, I got a call at my office from a student's sister. She sounded worried and explained that no one in the family had been able to reach her brother. This wasn't unusual, honestly. Families often panicked when their kids ignored their calls, not realizing it was usually just stress or avoidance. Still, part of the job was checking on them. Normally, I'd go with another staff member for safety and accountability, but that day I was short-staffed and figured it was harmless enough to check alone. When I reached the student's floor, the silence was thick. No one in sight, not even the usual stray footsteps or distant music. When I found his room, I immediately heard something, what sounded like a movie playing behind the door. The muffled sound of gunfire and voices told me he had either a TV or laptop running. I knocked firmly, announcing myself as staff checking in. Nothing. At first, I thought nothing of it. Students leave stuff running all the time. I checked the bathrooms and showers down the hall just in case, but they were empty. I came back, knocked again, and waited. Still no answer. That's when the uneasy feeling started creeping in. I had been doing this job long enough to know when something felt wrong. A family worried, electronics running, and a floor that felt completely dead. It didn't add up. Being alone didn't help. Empty dorms in broad daylight can be unsettling, like stepping into a hotel long after everyone's checked out. I decided to key into the room, even though technically I wasn't supposed to do it without another staff member. I gave one more knock and announced myself, then slid the key in. The moment I opened the door, every nerve in my body went tight. The room didn't look lived in the way you'd expect. Instead of unpacked drawers or shelves, there was just a half-open suitcase on the floor, clothes spilling out like the student had been living out of it. The bed was messy, sheets tangled as though someone had slept there recently, and every single light in the room was on. On the desk, a laptop played The Matrix on battery power, but the chair was empty. The entire room was empty. I stood there, rationalizing as fast as I could. Maybe he was downstairs grabbing food. Maybe I had just missed him on the way up. That had to be it. I almost turned and left when something caught my attention. The closet. Most students didn't use those old accordion doors. They were clunky and usually removed. But this room still had them, shut tight. A small part of me hoped the student was just hiding, maybe embarrassed about being checked on. Another part of me felt dread curl in my stomach. What if he had hurt himself in there? I knew I couldn't just leave without checking. I forced my voice to stay steady as I called out that I was opening the closet. My hand fumbled with the latch, slick with sweat, until it finally gave way. I pulled the doors open, bracing for the worst. What I saw wasn't anything I could have imagined. Inside, crouched like he had been hiding there the whole time, was a man. He was tall, far taller than I expected. His frame folded awkwardly to fit in the space. His skin was dark, his face expressionless, and he stared at me like I had just walked in on his secret. His eyes didn't blink, his chest barely moved. For at least 15 seconds, we just stared at each other. My mind scrambled for answers. Was this the student? He didn't look like a college kid. He looked older. his presence heavier somehow. The longer I stared, the more wrong it felt, like he wasn't supposed to be there at all. Finally, he spoke, his voice flat, almost embarrassed. He said he was hiding. That was it. The words didn't ease me. If anything, they made my skin crawl worse. Something in me didn't want to stay in that room another second. I stepped back, telling him to call his family because they were worried. He nodded, but it didn't feel like he cared. I shut the door behind me, my hands still shaking. The hall outside was silent again, but the weight of what I had just seen pressed against me. The rational part of my brain tried to piece it together. Maybe it was really the student. Maybe he was just shy. Maybe I had let my nerves spin it into something it wasn't. But another part of me knew what I saw wasn't normal. I've worked in dorms for years, and I've dealt with every kind of student, from the socially awkward.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
To the unstable. But that day, what I saw in that closet didn't feel like a stressed out kid. It felt like something else. Something that shouldn't have been there, watching me from the shadows, waiting for me to find it. I still wonder sometimes if anyone else saw him, or if I was the only one. Story 3. Some people are like locked doors. You think you know what's behind them, until suddenly they swing wide open and reveal something you never expected. That's what happened to me the day I met an older man at work, and it's one of the few moments in my life that made me question what's real and what isn't. Back then, I was working in Florida as a service manager at a large automotive dealership. My job was simple in theory, but messy in practice. I was the guy they called when customers were upset or when their car had one of those problems no one else seemed able to solve. Most days were stressful, filled with complaints, back and forth arguments, and paperwork. But this day started out normal. An older man came in with an issue. He was polite, calm, not at all like the usual frustrated crowd I dealt with. I figured it would be an easy case, so I suggested we go for a quick test drive to get a feel for his vehicle. In the car, we made small talk. Nothing unusual, just the kind of polite exchanges you have with strangers. Then out of nowhere, he asked me if I liked magic. I laughed it off at first, but before I could even respond properly, he started talking about me. What struck me immediately was that he wasn't asking questions. He wasn't fishing for information. He was just telling me things about my life, things he should have no way of knowing. He mentioned the state I was born in. That was odd enough since I was nearly 1,000 miles away from that place. But then he got more specific. He named a town not far from the hospital where I was born. He narrowed it down until he was within a 20-minute drive of the exact spot. My chest tightened. I hadn't told anyone at work that detail. He kept going, saying I hadn't stayed there long. He mentioned that I'd moved south to another city when I was young, and he nailed it, completely. He was describing the exact place my family had moved when I was a kid. At first, I thought maybe it was a lucky guess, or that I had slipped up earlier in the conversation without realizing it. But no, I hadn't said anything. He just knew. Before I could even process that, he did something even stranger. He rubbed his eyes, almost like he was clearing his vision, and began humming softly under his breath. The air in the car felt heavier in that moment, like a weight pressing against me. Then he casually asked how long I had lived in Norway. My stomach dropped. He didn't just mention the country. I could have maybe explained that away by saying I had a faint accent or something. He went further, narrowing it down to the exact city I had lived in for 8 years. At that point, I felt genuine fear. My mind scrambled for answers. Maybe he had looked me up somehow, done a background check. But how could he know about Norway? That was years of my life that weren't public knowledge. There was no way for him to know unless someone had told him directly, and I knew no one had. My friends wouldn't even think to share something like that with a random customer. The drive back to the dealership was surreal. My brain was spinning through every possible scenario, a setup, a prank, maybe some elaborate trick, but none of it fit. I didn't know this man. My coworkers didn't know this man. And yet he was describing details of my life like he'd been watching from the sidelines the entire time. When we pulled back into the lot, he leaned toward me slightly and said he was just having some fun. He claimed he had been in the CIA for years as a linguist and that he now used what he learned as a kind of party trick. I nodded and forced a laugh, but the truth is, that explanation didn't settle me. If anything, it made me more uneasy. Even if he had been in the CIA, even if he had some sort of training in reading people, how do you explain the precision of what he knew? He wasn't guessing. He wasn't piecing together clues from the way I talked. He named the hospital near where I was born. He named the city I moved to as a child. He named the city in Norway, where I had lived for nearly a decade. Those aren't details you can pull from someone's body language or tone of voice. For days afterward, I couldn't stop replaying the encounter in my head. I told myself there had to be a rational explanation. Maybe he had overheard something at the dealership before we left. Maybe he did know someone who knew me and had done his homework. But deep down, I couldn't shake the feeling that what I had experienced wasn't normal. The strange part is that during the whole thing, there were little signs that felt wrong. The way the air in the car shifted when he rubbed his eyes. The silence seemed to hang too heavy when he hummed. The way his calm demeanor never broke, as if he knew exactly how far to push without sending me running. Was he really just a retired linguist having some fun? Or was there something else going on? Was he someone who knew things he shouldn't, in ways we don't fully understand? I'll never know. What I do know is that for those 20 minutes in the car, I questioned everything I thought I knew about reality. And even now, years later, when I think about him, a part of me wonders if I had a brush with something supernatural. Something that wore the mask of a harmless old man, but was much more than that. Story 4. Life sometimes feels like walking across a thin sheet of glass. You think it'll hold, but you never know when something beneath might crack open. That's the best way I can describe the night I realized the world has corners you don't want to look into. I was still pretty young when it happened. I'd taken my German Shepherd to the park like I always did. He was a big dog, loyal and protective, the kind that made you feel safer just by having him at your side. We stayed out later than usual that evening, and by the time I noticed, the park was empty. The swings were still, the benches vacant, and the streetlights buzzing faintly above the pathways. It was one of those moments when you realize you're suddenly alone in a place that usually feels safe. As I clipped his lead back onto my belt, I heard movement near the far end of the park. Someone climbed the fence from the alleyway and dropped down onto the grass. At first, I thought maybe it was just another person cutting through, but something about him felt wrong. He wore a dark hood pulled over his head, and a scarf covered most of his face. He wasn't looking around or strolling casually. He was marching straight toward me. My dog hadn't noticed him yet. He was sniffing near a tree. But the instant the man got closer, my dog froze and stepped between us. His entire body changed. Hackles up, teeth bared, low growls rumbling from his chest. It was the kind of posture I'd never seen from him before. He was serious, locked onto the man like he was a threat. I had no idea what to do. The man kept coming, but when he finally saw the dog, he slowed. For a moment, none of us moved. My dog growled louder, muscles tense as if ready to lunge. I stood frozen, half terrified of what would happen if my dog actually attacked. The man didn't say anything, just shifted his weight, staring at us through that scarf. It turned into this strange standoff, me clutching the lead, my dog vibrating with anger, and this man looming a few yards away. After what felt like forever, he backed away. He didn't turn his back, just shuffled slowly before climbing back over the fence and disappearing into the alley. I quickly grabbed my dog's lead, and even as we walked home, he stayed on edge, ears pricked, eyes darting toward every sound. I remember thinking I was lucky to have him there. Without him, I don't even want to imagine what that man had planned. That should have been the end of it. A creepy encounter with a stranger, nothing more. But when we got home, things didn't feel right. My dog wouldn't settle. He paced the hallway all night, growling at the windows, ears flicking toward noises I couldn't hear. At one point, I thought I saw someone standing at the edge of my yard, but when I blinked, the spot was empty. The next few nights, the same thing happened. My dog growled at nothing, sometimes barking in the middle of the night, always at the same corner of the house. I never saw anything clearly, but I kept catching shadows where no shadows should be. I told myself it was just nerves, maybe paranoia after that incident. But my dog knew. He sensed something. A week later, walking him in daylight, he froze in the same park and stared at the fence where the man had appeared. His growls started again, low and steady, even though there was nobody there. The air felt heavy, like the moment before a storm. For the first time, I realized maybe it hadn't been a normal person that night. Maybe my dog hadn't been protecting me from a stranger at all. Even now, I'm not sure what to believe. It could have been some guy with bad intentions, and the fear just made me imagine the rest. But part of me thinks it was something else. Something that wore the shape of a man, but wasn't one. My dog saw it for what it was, and whatever it was, it didn't want to cross him. That's the part that still gives me chills. Story 5. Routine can feel like a safety net. You ride the same road enough times and your brain relaxes, telling you nothing unusual could possibly happen there. That's what I thought about the Toronto subway. It wasn't glamorous, but it was predictable. And in a city like Toronto, predictability is comforting. It was one of those weekends where the TTC was running on a half schedule, closing off downtown tracks for upgrades. The train I was on crawled along the rails, slower than usual, workers in orange vests moving in and out of view along the tunnel walls. I had taken that same route dozens of times, and I expected nothing different this night. When I got on, though, I noticed something strange right away. At the far end of the car was a woman sitting by herself, and around her was this bubble of emptiness. It wasn't just that the seats were open. People actively avoided being near her. I didn't hear her at first, but once the doors closed and the train started moving, I realized she was laughing. Not quietly either. It was sharp, loud, like she was laughing at something only she could see. Normally, I'd just crank up the volume in my headphones and block out that kind of weirdness. But it didn't work. My music couldn't drown her out. My brain just kept tuning her in, like it wanted me to focus on her. Eventually, I gave up, unplugged my earbuds, and tried to sit there like it wasn't getting under my skin. The train kept moving at its slow crawl, jerky and uneven because of the track work, and the whole thing already felt a little off. Then the lights flickered, and in the middle of one of those jerks, the power cut out. Everything went black. I wasn't alone in that car, but I might as well have been. The silence was instant. Her laughter cut off like someone pressed a switch. For a few seconds, there was nothing but the sound of my own breathing and the faint echo of metal creaking somewhere in the dark. I told myself not to panic. Subways lose power sometimes. Backup lights usually kick in. It would just be a minute. But those 5 seconds stretched out forever, and the longer the dark stayed, the more my body tensed. When the lights snapped back on, I didn't expect anything. I just wanted relief. But when my eyes adjusted, she wasn't at the far end anymore. She was 3 seats away. She didn't move. She didn't say a word. She just sat there, angled toward me, staring like she had been waiting for the lights to come back on so I'd see her there. My stomach dropped. I felt my chest tighten up in a way I can't explain, like my body already knew something was wrong before my brain could even react. She didn't blink. She didn't smile. Just stared. And the whole time the train rattled forward like nothing out of the ordinary had happened. I didn't wait to see what would happen next. The second the train slowed and the doors opened at my stop, I bolted. I didn't even look back to check if she followed. I just got off, walked as fast as I could up the stairs, and didn't breathe until I was on the street. What gets me is that she didn't try to say anything. She didn't laugh again after she moved. It was like she wanted me to notice that she had shifted closer, and that was it. To this day, I have no explanation. Maybe she ran down the aisle in the dark and sat closer, and my brain exaggerated it because I was already nervous. Maybe I just didn't hear her move. But the way the car had been completely silent, the way she was suddenly just there, something about it didn't feel human. I'll admit, it's the creepiest moment of my life, and I hope to God she was just some unstable person, because the alternative, that I actually encountered something I wasn't supposed to, still makes my skin crawl every time I step onto a train. Story 6. Life in the canyon at night can feel like standing inside a giant echo chamber, where every crunch, every shift of gravel, carries farther than it should. That winter, I decided to push myself, camping alone in the middle of nowhere with nothing but a heavy tent and a little stove for heat. The cold was brutal, dropping to zero, but the moon was bright, and the silence felt peaceful, almost safe. I had set up my tent near a canyon wall, far from anyone else, with no tracks leading in or out besides mine. The fire in the stove kept the fabric glowing faintly from the inside, and from above it probably looked like a small lantern in the middle of an endless, frozen desert. Around 2 a.m, I couldn't sleep, so I climbed a bit higher up the rocks, just to look down at the campsite. It was beautiful from up there, my tent glowing, the moon making everything silver. I felt calm, even proud, like I had conquered the night. That feeling lasted until I heard the crunch of gravel. It started faint. So far away I thought I imagined it, but the sound grew, carrying through the canyon until I could tell it was a vehicle. That unsettled me immediately. I had been there since noon and hadn't seen a single car. Who drives through that area in the middle of the night? Eventually, headlights came into view, crawling along the dirt road. The car was old, a boxy shape with patches of rust, and it moved slowly, too slowly. From where I was perched, I could see sparks of light inside, like someone flicking a lighter again and again. They were either smoking constantly or using it for something else I didn't want to think about. I stayed frozen where I was, hoping they would just pass. But when the car rounded the bend and my tent came into their view, the brake lights glowed red. The car slowed, then nearly stopped. They lingered, staring at the tent from the road. It couldn't have been more than a minute, but it stretched on forever. My stomach twisted. Down there, I had no weapon but a small hatchet, and I was too far to intervene. Eventually, the car rolled on, disappearing down the road. Relief washed over me, but I didn't move. Something felt wrong. The canyon made every sound travel, so I waited. Sure enough, a few minutes later, I heard the crunch of gravel again, closer this time. The car had turned around. They parked some distance away, and I watched figures step out. Under the moonlight, I could see them walking slowly down the road toward my camp. My heart pounded. They weren't carrying flashlights, but the night was so bright it didn't matter. From above, I could see everything, their shadows stretching long across the slick rock as they approached. I stayed low, not even daring to shift my weight, just watching as they circled my tent. They peered into the vents, right where my sleeping bag was laid out. From their angle, it probably looked like I was inside. One of them bent down, examining my gear outside the tent. Another moved to my vehicle, rattling the handle before stepping back. They walked slowly, deliberately, as though they were deciding what to do next. Minutes dragged on, every second stretching until it felt unbearable. I was sure they would cut the tent open, sure they'd break into the car, sure they'd wait for me. But after inspecting everything in silence, they finally walked back the way they came, their shapes shrinking until the car swallowed them up. Then, with one last echo of gravel, they were gone. I didn't move until the sky began to lighten. The thought of climbing down, of walking right past where they had stood, froze me in place. Only when dawn broke did I return to camp, quickly breaking down the stove and packing everything into the car. That's when I saw the footprints, clear marks in the thin layer of snow, pressed right outside the walls of my tent, circling it. If I had stayed inside instead of climbing the rocks, I would have woken up to those prints, never knowing who made them or what they wanted. After that night, I changed how I camped. I carried a beacon, alarms, and a shotgun. I swapped my big glowing tent for something smaller, less obvious, sometimes even sleeping a short distance away, and leaving the tent as bait, because what happened wasn't a ghost story, at least not in the traditional sense. But watching strangers stalk your camp in the middle of nowhere, knowing how close they were to finding you, that's as supernatural as it gets when you're alone under the moonlight. Story 7. Living in that old house in the hills was like living inside a forgotten photograph. Everything about it felt frozen in time, from the way the wooden beams creaked under your feet to the fact that the windows only faced front and back. I had asked why the place was built like that, and the answer I got was unsettling in its own way. The houses in that area were designed so the slaves walking between them couldn't look in. That piece of history clung to the walls. You could feel it, like the air carried more than dust inside those rooms. The house belonged to a family friend, and before we moved in, we were told it was special. No details, no explanation, just a warning tossed out like it was supposed to mean something. At first, I didn't pay much attention to it. The place felt strange, sure, but not threatening. It was more like living inside a story you couldn't quite figure out. Things happened often enough that I stopped questioning whether the house was off. Items shifted on their own, doors wouldn't stay shut, and the whole property seemed to carry its own rhythm. But none of it prepared me for what I saw one night a few months before I moved away. Across the street, past the narrow strip of road, there was an open field that rolled into the base of the mountains. Maybe 300 yards up, the ridge climbed high enough that you could see it stretch across the horizon. On top of that ridge stood a single antenna, nothing special except for the light. At night, it always glowed steady, never blinking, never fading, just a white dot against the sky. It became such a normal part of the view that I barely noticed it anymore. One evening, when I stepped outside to use the outhouse, I realized something wasn't right. The light was gone. At first, I figured maybe I wasn't standing in the right spot. I walked down the driveway a little, trying to get a better angle, but what I saw made me stop cold. The entire sky behind the ridge burst into brightness. It wasn't like lightning or fire. It was more like giant floodlights aimed straight up, washing the clouds with a glow so strong it looked unnatural. Except there were no clouds that night. The sky was perfectly clear, and there was no snow or anything on the ground that could reflect light like that. The silence that came with it made my skin crawl. The hills were usually filled with insects, owls, and the kind of background noise you only notice when it stops. That night, it was dead quiet, as if the whole world held its breath. I should have gone inside right then, but curiosity pulled me forward. I wanted to see what was making that light. I walked a little further, staring at the glow, trying to make sense of it. That's when I noticed someone coming down the street, a man. He appeared from the left side of the road, walking fast in my direction. It didn't make sense. This was a remote neighborhood. There were only two other houses on the street, and it was rare to see anyone walking at night. Something about the way he moved was off, not threatening exactly, but urgent, like he had a purpose. When he got close enough, he spoke. His tone was calm but carried an edge of warning, telling me I didn't want to go over there. That threw me off. I hadn't planned on climbing the ridge, but I asked him why, trying to keep the conversation casual. He claimed he couldn't say but repeated that I didn't want to be involved. His words made no sense. How could he know I didn't want a part of it if he didn't know what it was? I pointed toward the ridge, where the light now pulsed slowly, fading and brightening again like it was alive. I said it was weird, admitted I was curious. That's when his whole demeanor shifted. His voice dropped into something heavy and unsettling, like he wasn't just giving advice anymore. He was delivering a message. He told me my eyes weren't meant to see. The way he said it didn't feel personal. It was bigger than me, like he meant all of humanity. I glanced back up at the ridge, unsettled, my mind racing with questions. But when I turned back toward him, he was gone. Not walking away, not fading into the distance, just gone. In the 5 seconds I had looked away, he disappeared. The road stretched straight in both directions. Even if he had sprinted, there was nowhere for him to vanish to. My chest tightened and my legs felt weak. Between the lights in the sky and this stranger who spoke like a messenger, I hit my limit. I hurried back inside and told my roommate everything, urging him to come outside with me to see it for himself. By the time we stepped back out, the ridge was dark again. The glow was gone, and the antenna's steady white light had returned, like nothing had happened. Later that night, when the adrenaline finally gave me enough space to think, I decided maybe there was a rational explanation. Maybe it was some kind of construction, or testing, or even a weird weather phenomenon. But when I pulled up Google Maps and zoomed in on the other side of the ridge, the map showed nothing. No buildings, no roads, no trace of human activity, just endless wooded ridges and blank space. The satellite view didn't help. It showed nothing but wilderness where that light had been. I tried to reason it out. Maybe the man was local. Maybe there was something happening I wasn't supposed to see. But every time I replayed it in my head, I came back to the same two details. The impossible light and the fact that the man vanished without a trace. It didn't feel like a coincidence. It felt like I had been stopped on purpose, kept from crossing into something I wasn't supposed to witness. To this day, I can't say for sure if what I encountered that night was paranormal, supernatural, or something else entirely. All I know is that I walked outside expecting nothing more than the usual, and instead ended up with an experience that made me question what normal even means. Story 8. College life felt like being on a conveyor belt. You went through the same motions every day, surrounded by the same faces, sitting in the same unspoken seats, like puzzle pieces that always fit the same way. That's why it hit me so hard when something happened one afternoon that didn't fit into that pattern at all. I was a sophomore at the time, walking into my math class like I always did. I went straight to my usual spot, four seats in from the aisle, third row. Nobody ever claimed seats, but everyone fell into their own routine. To my left, two seats down, there was always the same girl, and next to her, her friend, a guy who was always joking around with her. They weren't a couple, just close friends, and they always filled the space with quiet laughter or whispers before class started. Nothing about them ever seemed unusual. That day, I slid into my chair, pulled out my spiral notebook and pencil, and settled in. I remember just staring ahead at the whiteboard, letting my thoughts drift. I was thinking about lunch, what homework I had, and what I'd do later that night. Everything was normal, until this strange, heavy feeling crept over me. It was like the sensation you get when someone is staring directly at you, even before you look. I turned my head slightly to the left, and that's when my whole body froze. The girl who usually sat there wasn't laughing or chatting with her friend. She was staring straight at me. Her face was completely blank, not angry, not happy, not anything, just empty. But what made my chest tighten was her eyes. They weren't normal eyes anymore. They were glowing, sharp, and impossibly bright, like electric blue lights. It was as if someone had taken two lasers and shoved them into her sockets. I couldn't move. My body refused to react. I couldn't even open my mouth to say something. My eyes locked onto hers, and for those seconds, though it felt like minutes, I felt like something was pressing down on me, pinning me to the chair. There was no blinking, no shift in her expression, just those shining blue eyes drilling into me. Finally, I forced myself to blink and look away. My heart was pounding so hard I could feel it in my throat. I stared forward, trying to act normal, convincing myself it was just my imagination or maybe a trick of the light. When I finally worked up the courage to glance back, everything looked normal again. Her head was turned toward her friend, and he was talking about something, while she nodded along. Her eyes looked totally ordinary, as if nothing had ever happened. I tried to brush it off. Maybe I had been daydreaming too much, or maybe my contacts were dry, causing me to hallucinate. But the rest of that class felt endless. I couldn't focus on the lesson. My skin crawled every time I thought about those piercing blue eyes. It didn't end there, though. For the rest of that semester, I couldn't shake the feeling that she knew I had seen something I wasn't supposed to. She never looked at me again the same way she had that day, but I kept catching small glimpses, quick glances when she thought I wasn't paying attention. Sometimes I'd swear her eyes would flash unnaturally bright for a split second before looking normal again. One time, weeks later, I was walking across campus at night after a late study session. Out of nowhere, I felt that same eerie weight pressing down on me, that sensation of being watched. When I turned, there was no one behind me. But in the windows of a nearby building, I caught a reflection that didn't make sense. A figure, small and faint, but those same glowing blue eyes burned in the glass before vanishing. I told myself it was stress, lack of sleep, maybe even my brain exaggerating what happened in that classroom. That was the skeptic in me fighting back. But deep down, I couldn't forget the raw terror of that first moment, the paralysis, the absolute certainty that what I was seeing wasn't human, or at least wasn't entirely human. I never confronted her. I didn't have the courage. When the semester ended, I switched schedules and never saw her again. But now and then, when I catch someone's eyes in just the right light and they shine a little too bright, I remember sitting in that classroom, frozen in my seat, staring at something I couldn't explain. Maybe it was nothing. Maybe it was a trick of light or a tired mind misfiring. But if you'd been there in that chair, you'd understand why I can't convince myself of that. Story 9. Life as a child feels like an endless treasure hunt. Every stick can become a sword, every bug is a monster, and every shadow hides something waiting to be discovered. That's how I felt one summer, when I was around 7 or 8, running freely in a California park that was completely different from the neighborhood where I grew up. We were visiting family, and while my parents and my aunt stayed within earshot, I had the kind of freedom I usually only dreamed of: open woods, crooked trees to climb, dirt under my nails. I was tearing around, chasing whatever caught my eye, when I spotted it, a fox. Its fur was reddish gold, brighter than anything I'd ever seen in the wild. I hadn't grown up around animals like that, and my brain just locked onto it. Without even thinking, I bolted after it. The fox ran ahead, but it didn't seem scared. It didn't sprint away like I expected. It just kept moving a little faster than me, always close enough that I could see it, but never close enough to touch. It led me downhill, through brush and trees that grew at weird angles. I was too determined to stop, so I slid, stumbled, scrambled my way after it. My heart was pounding, but it was excitement, not fear. I just wanted to see where it went. At the bottom of the hill, there was a clearing with a massive tree at the center. At its base, tucked into the roots, was a makeshift lean-to. It wasn't a regular animal den. Someone had dug out a pit and leaned sticks, branches, and even bits of cardboard over it, like a half-hidden fort. The fox trotted straight into it, disappearing from view. When I finally caught up, something else crawled out of the lean-to. Not the fox, a girl. She looked about my age, maybe younger. Her hair was messy, full of leaves, and she wore denim overalls with no shoes. For a second, I thought maybe another kid had built the fort and was living there. But then something about her stopped me cold. The fox was gone, and there was no way out of that shelter that I could see. And the way she looked at me, like she'd been waiting for me, didn't feel like any normal coincidence. She stood proudly and explained things in a way that only kids, or maybe something else, could. She said she was the fox. Not that she'd owned it, not that she'd seen it, but that she was it. She said sometimes she looked like this instead. She even bragged about what she did for fun: catching bugs, hunting birds and mice, and stealing cinnamon buns from vending machines. None of it struck me as strange at the time. I was just a curious kid meeting someone new. I didn't question her. I believed her because, in that moment, there was no reason not to. And we played. We searched for rocks and pill bugs. She showed off how fast she could run, how far she could leap, and how easily she snatched bugs out of the dirt with her bare hands. I was in awe, and every time I said something was cool, she seemed to glow with pride. When I pulled out the paperback I'd been carrying around, she treated it like some rare treasure. I even thought about giving it to her, though I can't remember if she told me she couldn't read or if that's a detail I convinced myself of years later. Time slipped away down there, in that little clearing with the giant tree. My parents' voices eventually cut through the quiet, calling my name. They sounded more urgent, more worried than I'd realized. I panicked, mumbled a quick goodbye, and sprinted back up the hill to them. They were angry, scolding me for wandering so far. I didn't tell them about the girl, or the fox, or the fort. It just didn't feel like something I could explain. And that was it. I never saw her again. I don't even know if I ever went back to that park. If I did, it wasn't on that trip. I couldn't tell you now where it was exactly, other than somewhere near Berkeley or Albany. At the time, it was just an afternoon adventure that I filed away like all the other childhood memories. It was only years later that I thought back and realized how strange it really was. How a fox turned into a barefoot girl who seemed more wild than human. How I spent what felt like hours away from my family without them seeing me, and how they swore I'd only been gone a short time. How she bragged about stealing food from machines she shouldn't have been able to reach, and how she'd looked at me with eyes that didn't feel like any kids I'd met before. I don't know who I met that day. Perhaps it was just another child with an overactive imagination, or maybe my memory has distorted it into something bigger than it was. Or maybe I stumbled onto something I wasn't supposed to see. All I know is I can still picture her crouched low in the dirt, hair full of leaves, cupped hands springing forward to snatch a beetle, grinning at me like I just witnessed a magic trick. Story 10. Life can feel like a scratched record sometimes, playing the same loop over and over. Then every once in a while, something jumps the track, and you realize you're not as grounded in reality as you thought. That's what happened to me one random afternoon, and it's stuck in my head ever since. I was walking near the hospital in my town, and it was a normal day. The weather was plain, the street was quiet, and I wasn't expecting anything memorable. That's why the man I crossed paths with stands out so clearly. He didn't look dirty or out of place the way someone struggling might. Instead, it was his clothes that immediately threw me off. They weren't normal, but I couldn't explain why. Every piece of clothing looked tailored, like it was made specifically for him, but it didn't match any style I've ever seen. Not futuristic exactly, not old-fashioned either. Just slightly wrong. Almost like someone tried to copy modern clothing from memory and got the details skewed. He had this energy about him, jittery but excited, like someone who just walked out of a room full of secrets. He stepped right up to me and asked what time it was. I told him, thinking that was all he needed, but he shook his head and repeated the question. Only this time he wanted the date. I gave it to him, and the way his face changed has haunted me. He looked both relieved and unsettled at the same time, like he'd confirmed something important, but didn't like the answer. He thanked me quickly, then bolted down the street, moving fast but with no clear direction.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
First, I brushed it off. My mind went to the most logical explanations. Maybe he was a psychiatric patient from the hospital nearby. It wouldn't be unusual. Or maybe he was cosplaying something obscure I didn't recognize. But the thing is, there wasn't any sign that he was pretending. He wasn't putting on a performance for strangers, no smirk or playfulness. It felt dead serious, almost desperate. That night, I kept replaying the scene in my head. The clothes bothered me most. Not just the cut of them, but the fabric. They had this strange sheen, like they'd been made from material I couldn't quite identify. The buttons didn't look like buttons. The shoes were seamless, almost molded. It was all just slightly off in ways I couldn't put into words. I kept trying to reason it out. Maybe some designer outfit, maybe a niche style, but nothing fit. The next few weeks, little things kept messing with me. A couple of nights after, I woke up at 3 a.m. and swore I heard footsteps outside my apartment window. I live on the second floor. There was no balcony, no reason for anyone to be there. Yet the sound of pacing went on for nearly 10 minutes. When I finally worked up the courage to look, there was nothing. Another time, I was walking home from work and thought I saw the same man standing across the street. He wasn't watching me directly, but his stance, his build, even the way his clothes caught the light, it all looked the same. As soon as I noticed him, a bus passed between us, and when it moved on, he was gone. Maybe it was just someone else. Maybe I was paranoid. But it rattled me. The weirdest moment came about a month later. I was cleaning my apartment and picked up an old digital clock I hadn't used in years. It was unplugged. The batteries had been dead forever. Yet the display flickered for a second when I touched it. The numbers showed the exact time of my encounter with the man, 1:30 p.m. I froze, staring at it, trying to convince myself I'd imagined it. The clock never turned on again, even when I put fresh batteries in. I know the rational explanation is that the guy was from the hospital, confused and disoriented, asking random people for the date. That would explain everything neatly, but I can't shake the other possibility. The clothes, the urgency, the way he reacted to the date, it all lines up too well with what people imagine a time traveler might be like. He wasn't lost in a normal sense. He was lost in time. It's been years since I last saw him, but every time I pass that hospital, I remember the expression on his face and the way he ran. I still can't decide which possibility unsettles me more, that he was a sick man in trouble or that I briefly crossed paths with someone who didn't belong in our time at all.